It is Monday, February the 6th. This is VOA's International Edition. So good to have you with us. Coming up, President Trump making somewhat positive comments about Russia.
If he's going to make those comments, he really ought to explain a little bit more why he thinks that Russia has really changed under Vladimir Putin, because it actually hasn't in any serious way.
Also ahead, the Trump travel ban and various protests, plus corruption in Romania, what's trending on social media, and we say goodbye to some heavy-duty rock and rollers. Everyone, I'm Steve Norman. Just the other day, President Trump signed an executive order restricting travel for some to the United States. While highly unpopular overseas, the 90-day entry ban on citizens from seven countries is supported by roughly one half of all Americans, according to the polls, and is consistent with repeated promises made by Mr. Trump during his election campaign. Homeland Security Chief John Kelly insisted at a news conference last week that the ban is not aimed specifically at Muslims.
The vast majority of the 1.7 billion Muslims that live on this planet, the vast majority of them, have all other things being equal, have access to the United States. And a relatively small number right now are being held up for a period of time until we can take a look at what their procedures are.
Kelly said his agency's mission, in his words, is to safeguard the American people, our homeland, and our values. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman tells my colleague Jim Stevenson the discussion remains a hot topic.
Jim, this week-old ban has been subject to many challenges in court. And the latest came from Seattle, but was applied by a federal judge in Seattle nationwide. In other words, putting the brakes on President Trump's executive order when it comes to the travel ban from seven predominantly Muslim nations, as well as the refugee ban worldwide. And perhaps lost in some of the news coverage is some of the actual language of this judge's decision. It said that states have demonstrated that they face immediate and irreparable injury as a result of the signing and implementation of this executive order. These harms are significant and ongoing. The judge, James Robart in Seattle, said that these states have demonstrated that aside from any human rights concerns, and constitutional concerns, that there's an actual economic detriment that comes when people cannot travel freely and when companies cannot rely on employees coming back into the country, when universities can't rely on professors coming back into the country, or students for that matter, and that there is a generalized harm here. And so he put the brakes on it. And as you might expect, President Trump had something to say about it.
On Twitter, of course.
Yes, yes. Donald Trump took to Twitter, and as is his wont, he said, quote, "The opinion of this so-called judge is ridiculous and will be overturned. A terrible decision. Many very bad and dangerous people may be pouring into our country." And this, as you might expect, has provoked a certain amount of response from Washington, in fact, from those that I cover at the Senate. And a fairly prominent sort of young and up-and-coming senator by the name of Ben Sasse of Nebraska, a conservative Republican, went on television on Sunday and said, "We have no so-called judges in America. We have judges. We have actual judges. We have actual presidents. And we have actual lawmakers. There are three branches of government." He said that he shares Donald Trump's concern about the possible entry of terrorists into the United States from abroad. But he said that the way that Donald Trump has gone about it is, to use his word, clunky. And that's something that the courts have agreed with. And of course, Democrats have been piling on this issue all week long.
While very controversial, this is a great lesson in America's checks and balances in the system that was set up.
Indeed. I mean, consider this. You have a newly inaugurated president, arguably at the height of his power, presidents, when they come in, there's a honeymoon period, and arguably Donald Trump is at the pinnacle of the power that he is going to enjoy. And you have a single district court judge on the other side of the country signing a document that kicks out the entire executive order until and unless a higher court acts. And this has gone to an appellate court, which refused to get involved in it initially, although they have asked for more documents to be filed. This could go through the appellate court, and it could ultimately wind up at the Supreme Court, where, guess what? There are only 8 justices, and Donald Trump has named a 9th to fill that one vacancy. This could be a really interesting couple of months coming up right here in Washington.
That is VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman speaking with VOA's Jim Stevenson. And as we mentioned a bit ago, the Trump travel ban sparked a lot of international attention, and quite a bit here in the U.S. as well. Tens of thousands took to the streets of cities all over the world just after Mr. Trump signed the executive action, which created the ban, and has been not let up since then. This woman, coming up, was among protesters outside the U.S. Embassy in London over the weekend.
I think it's ridiculous. Like, so many of my friends are Muslim, and I don't agree with that at all. How can you base someone on their religion not to come to the country? Not all Muslims are terrorists. That's not true. It's not the religion. It's not the religion. It's their ideology, and that's not right.
And as I noted earlier, the Trump administration has repeated its contention that the travel ban is not about religion. President Trump addressed the travel ban in his weekly message.
I will never forget that my responsibility is to keep you, the American people, safe and free. That's why last week I signed an executive order to help keep terrorists out of our country. The executive order establishes a process to develop new vetting and mechanisms to ensure those coming into America love and support our people, that they have good intentions.
And that message was released on the internet while Mr. Trump was at his vacation home in the state of Florida, where a number of demonstrators gathered to show their opposition not only to the travel ban, but to the Trump presidency.
It's hard to pick one thing that people are upset about. I feel like our rights are under attack from all angles. It seems like a shock and awe campaign designed to dishearten us, but we're not going to be disheartened. And we feel like Donald Trump does not deserve a vacation here. We don't get a vacation from the attack on our rights, the attack on our liberties, the attack on our lives.
The weekend protests were part of 3 weeks of demonstrations targeting Mr. Trump's demeanor as well as his policies. And one of those policies, or at least some consider it a policy, is Russia, its president, Vladimir Putin, and the future relationship between the U.S. and Moscow under the Trump administration. President Trump appeared on a special edition of the Fox News program, The O'Reilly Factor, with host Bill O'Reilly.
Do you respect Putin?
I do respect him.
Do you? Why?
Well, I respect a lot of people, but that doesn't mean I'm going to get along with him. He's a leader of his country. I say it's better to get along with Russia than not. And if Russia helps us in the fight against ISIS, which is a major fight, and Islamic terrorism all over the world,
right?
Major fight, that's a good thing. Will I get along with him? I have no idea.
He's a killer, though. Putin's a killer.
A lot of killers. We got a lot of killers. Why, you think our country's so innocent?
Mr. Trump's Vice President Mike Pence appeared on the NBC News program Meet the Press.
What you have in this president is an absolute determination to re-engage the world. I see it in the telephone calls with world leaders. We saw it when Prime Minister May came. But it's to re-engage world leaders on American interests, to bring American strength back to the world stage. Okay. And in President Donald Trump, people know that here's someone who knows how to put a deal together. And if he can make a deal with Russia or other countries that's going to advance the security of the American people and advance the interest of peace in the world, we're going to look to do that.
U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar, the Democrat from the state of Minnesota, does not think Russia can be won over by Mr. Trump. She appeared on the ABC News program this week with George Stephanopoulos.
You cannot compare any leaders in our country to what Vladimir Putin has done. This is a man and a regime that has taken down a passenger plane in Ukraine, killing hundreds of people. This is a regime that has been known to poison human rights activists. This is a regime that we believe 17 intelligence agencies in our own country have said has tried to influence our own election.
Yes, Russia has been accused by some of interfering in the November U.S. presidential election and possibly swaying the win to President Trump. Well, picking up on Mr. Trump's comments earlier about Russia during his interview with Bill O'Reilly, VOA's Victor Beatty asked Russia scholar Jonathan Adelman of the University of Denver for his thoughts on Mr. Trump's comments about Vladimir Putin.
I think it was a little odd. I mean, because first of all, Russia does not have a democratic regime. And secondly, a number of people have been killed. Since it happened in Russia, we aren't able to investigate that, but let's just say they disappear or something happens to them, or in London or in other places. And thirdly, the average American, when they think, especially middle-aged or older, when they think about Russia, naturally thinks about the Cold War for 40 years and thinks about how we nearly had nuclear war over Cuba in 1962. So it's a very odd thing to say. And, you know, he's just about 70 years old. He certainly remembers all of that. And if he's going to make those comments, he really ought to explain a little bit more why he thinks that Russia has really changed under Vladimir Putin, because it actually hasn't in any serious way.
There seems to be the core issue that the president wants to work with Russia on such issues as Ukraine and also Syria and the fight against Islamic State. Do you see that as the core issue that he's trying to elucidate?
Well, yeah, I think he believes that, and some of that would be good. If certainly eliminating ISIS would be progress for the rest of the world. But take Syria, for example. The Russians are not going to negotiate. They have won an outstanding victory. They've come back from, you know, being absolutely considered a third-rate state after the disintegration of the Soviet Union in 1991. And now they've won this major victory together with what they've won in left bank Ukraine and what they won in Crimea and what they won, you know, in Georgia and South Ossetia and Abkhazia. So it seems very unlikely. And we can see it in their behavior in the last couple of years, where they said they were attacking ISIS, but about 80% of the time they were busy attacking pro-Western rebels. So good luck. I mean, you know, if you could do that in the world, sure. But what are the odds? If you were sitting there, and I even gave a course in the Russian foreign ministry a few years ago. If you're sitting in Moscow, you only want one thing: more. This has been really good under Obama, and if it could continue under Donald Trump, they will say or do whatever is necessary because they want the most important thing, Russia to again become a superpower, even though it's got a very weak economy. And thus far, they've been able to do a lot to give that impression.
There are some concerns that the Trump administration will seek to lift sanctions on Russia that stem from its 2014 annexation of the Crimea. Vice President Pence on U.S. television Sunday said, "We're watching the events unfold in Ukraine, very troubled by the increased hostilities over the past week." He said, as far as the sanctions are concerned, quote, "I think that's a question that will be answered in the months ahead. It just simply all depends."
Well, I think, you know, Pence, unlike Donald Trump, is capable of being very diplomatic, and that was a very diplomatic answer. But the problem is, if you see it from Moscow's point of view, and I've been there a number of times, it doesn't make sense. The question is, what am I, you know, it's the art of the deal from the Russian point of view, which is, okay, now, what else can we get while the getting is good? And especially if the Americans are partly perceived as American firsters, neo-isolationists, going to be retreating, why would we want to give up anything? Right now, we are on a roll, and we're even working with the Iranians, of all people whom they don't like, and the Turks for victory, you know, here in Syria, and a victory in Ukraine. I mean, we tend to forget that. We see it from our point of view. So I think it's possible, but to tell you the truth, I think it is very unlikely.
The Senate leader, Mitch McConnell, responding to Mr. Trump's remarks that were released in advance of the broadcast interview, said there is no moral equivalency with the way the Russians conduct themselves and the way the United States does. Referring to Mr. Putin, he said he's a former KGB agent, a thug, not elected in any way that most people consider a credible election.
Well, I wouldn't go quite so far, but basically I'd be with McConnell. I mean, as I was just saying, there's no question that this is an authoritarian, conservative, nationalist regime faced with a terrible economy. They're at 10% now of the United States, and they used to be at 50 at one point. And the fact that they are able to be so successful says a great deal about how much the rest of the world is paying any serious attention to them.
What would be the best U.S. policy toward Russia?
The best policy would be to negotiate, but to be extraordinarily careful, because whatever the words are mean one thing to us and one thing to the other side. The one thing that's correct is we don't want another war with the Russians. You know, they were on our side in World War II, strangely enough. But we need to proceed with extreme caution. And then, therefore, that leads to one final point. We're not quite sure what to do with a president who tweets sometimes numerous times every day. We're not quite sure, does that mean something, or is that just his way of expressing things and staying in touch with his followers, or what? I think it's just too early right now in the Trump presidency to really know the answer to that question. I think in a couple of months we'll have a better idea.
That's Jonathan Adelman. He is a professor at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies, all of that at the University of Denver. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on the Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Also in the news, recovering after 6 days of huge public protest, Romania's Social Democrat government on Sunday repealed a contentious cabinet decree that would have shielded many politicians from prosecution for corruption. Dudu Florin was one of the protesters in Bucharest.
It took them a couple of days to make this step aside. I'm not considering a fully step behind, because there is some damage still in the legal papers they put in the official gazette, and it is already a huge legal debate on the real effects and the consequences of what they have voted and in the government and what they have published in the official gazette. However, it's important that they understood Romania is a strong democracy, people are in the street, and you cannot avoid doing the right thing.
A push launched in 2014 by Romania's newly formed National Anti-Corruption Directorate has led to abuse of power convictions of nearly 2,000 people, among them judges, politicians, prosecutors, and other public officials. Well, it's time now to shift our attention to social media. What's trending out that? Lori London is in for G. Abby Lee today. Hey, Lori, what's the word?
Well, the word is all about the biggest sports event in the United States. That would be, of course, Super Bowl 51, by the way.
Really? Never heard of it.
I know. Just won by the New England Patriots. But we've been seeing all kinds of stuff on social media all day, from photos of game time food, like guacamole and chicken wings, to comments about commercials. And right now, we've seen lots and lots and lots of talk about Lady Gaga's halftime performance. Mm. You know?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, you do. All right. Well, we've been seeing hashtag Lady Gaga and hashtag Super Bowl. She made quite an entrance. I don't know if you saw it, but she literally entered through the roof of the stadium, swinging on a trapeze wire, with drones, fans, even skeptics giving her props for that.
Yeah. Pretty neat.
It was very cool. We've been hearing from all kinds of people, including former Vice President Joe Biden, who tweeted, incredible performance from my friend at Lady Gaga. You amaze me. And not just on stage, proud to work with you to end sexual assault. Comedian Ellen DeGeneres tweeted, that was so incredible. Other tweets, America the Beautiful is beautiful because of women like Gaga.
All right.
So people are definitely praising her also, by the way, for not making any outward political statements.
Yeah, and I guess was that expected? I mean, she is political.
Yeah, she definitely is, given what's happening in the U.S. Politics has made its way into the game this year with lots of commercials with an undertone. And Donald Trump supporters actually were expecting a message from Gaga. They actually were tweeting before the game even began. One of them was in all caps, Houston Super Bowl attendees boo Lady Gaga off the stage. Make America great again. Another retweet was, retweet if you're going to boycott the halftime Super Bowl. So They were expecting that, but she really didn't.
Yeah, that didn't happen.
No,
yeah,
it didn't.
Know, absolutely. Anything else about the game being talked about?
Well, you know, just last month, people were tweeting concerns about the health of former President George H.W. Bush and his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Well, both of them actually are attending the game, which is in their hometown of Houston. And the former president was brought onto the field in a wheelchair alongside his wife, who was riding in a golf cart. And the crowd actually erupted into cheers. And Bush actually then did the official coin toss. So it was a very, really humbling.
That's neat.
Absolutely. Well, that's all I got for you today, Steve.
Not going to tell us about the dog?
Oh, okay. Well, if you want to hear about that,
I forgot about the dogs.
Okay. Yeah. Well, for people who don't like football, there's the Puppy Bowl. Puppy Bowl 13, hashtag Puppy Bowl 13 was trending today. It showed lots of photos of dogs hoping to be adopted. A rescue dog named Alexander Hamilpup was tweeting himself, by the way. His handle, A Hamilpup, said, "Thankfully, I found my forever home, but some of my teammates and rescues around the world are still looking for theirs."
Wonder how you tweet without thumbs.
I don't know, but a lot of dogs are doing it these days.
Yeah, it seems like it. Many, many thanks.
You got it.
International Edition's Lori London in for G. Abby Lee, as we mentioned earlier. You can follow Lori on Twitter if you'd like. What's your Twitter address?
It's at Lori London with a U.
With a U. Okay, there you go. I'm there too, VOA Norman. International Edition's there at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's Dawn spacecraft discovered a cryovolcano or ice volcano on the dwarf planet Ceres back in 2015. Called Ahuna Mons, scientists say that it appears to be the only mountain on the dwarf planet. A new study led by researchers at the University of Arizona proposes that Ahuna Mons may have also had a number of siblings millions or billions of years ago, but have since flattened and blended into the landscape. The study proposes that a method called viscous relaxation is responsible. With this process, just about any solid will eventually flow and flatten with enough time. Since the Ceres volcano contains ice, the researchers think the idea of viscous relaxation wearing down the sibling mountains is possible. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. So good to have you with us. You know, it's time now to move over to the music department, and we have something today about a half-century milestone being reached. Black Sabbath, they virtually started the heavy metal genre. Saturday night, the band ended their last ever tour with the final concert in Birmingham, England, their hometown, where it all began nearly 50 years ago. The crowds at the National Exhibition Center Arena were hopping and popping to the sounds of guitarist Tony Iommi, lead singer Ozzy Osbourne, bass guitarist Geezer Butler, and drummer Bill Ward. Black Sabbath got together in 1968 and created a sound very much like the music you would find in horror films. Reporters caught up with Osbourne Saturday night and asked him why the band is calling it quits.
It's run its course, really. I mean, it just felt right, you know. I mean, it just felt right. I mean, when we did the first Black Sabbath album, I can remember thinking, it'd be all right for a couple of years. It can't have been put in a barrel and rolled down the biggest mountain in the world ever, and you can't, you know, and you're like 49 years later.
Black Sabbath kicked off their farewell tour of 81 concerts in January last year here in the United States. That world tour took them to Australia, to Europe, North America again, South America, and then back to Europe to finish in Birmingham with two shows. This is Ozzy Osbourne singing the group's big hit, Paranoid, back in 1970. While there have been tons of tributes to the band in recent days, like Frank Bello, the bass guitarist for the thrash metal band Anthrax.
I never say goodbye. Number one, I can't imagine a world without Sabbath. And so I never say goodbye because I'll always pray, and I'll be bugging Giza for this, about a one-off show somewhere. And hopefully, you know, that we'll be able to see somewhere. So I never say never, right? Because I think Sabbath is forever.
Pyrotechnics went off as Black Sabbath took their final bow. The band then put their arms around each other and posed for a farewell photo as the crowds cheered behind them. There you go. Bye-bye, Black Sabbath. Oh, they'll probably still be around. Listen, many thanks for joining us. Latest world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Certain aspects of the United States government are unique, none more so than the law of the land, the United States Constitution. Drafted in 1787 and ratified in 1789, it is the oldest such written document in continual use, and one that has influenced legal thinking and other constitutions around the globe. The Constitution's preamble, or introduction, begins with the words, "We the people," indicating that although the document was written to establish a national government, the government itself was set up to serve the people, and derives its power from them. The body of the document sets out the balance and separation of power among the three branches of government: the legislative, or lawmaking branch, that is the U.S. Congress, the executive branch, which is headed by the president, and the judiciary, which interprets the law at every level and settles legal disputes regarding the meaning and application of the law. Having just won a war to rid themselves of an authoritarian government, the framers of the Constitution were above all careful to create a national government that would not, could not, wield absolute power, but at the same time could not be superseded by individual states. So the Constitution defines the state's relationship to the federal government, as well as the rights and responsibilities of state governments. And, to ensure the document is flexible enough to stand the test of time, the framers made provisions that allowed for it to be changed or amended to reflect changes within society itself. Ironically, this helped the Constitution to overcome its first major hurdle: ratification by the 13 states that made up the United States of the time. That's because the populace, which had just freed itself from shackles imposed on it by one government, was loath to agree to empowering another such body. Many saw a strong central government as a threat to individual rights. So, to obtain ratification in the several vacillating states, 10 amendments, collectively named the Bill of Rights, were added. In the words of James Madison, who is considered to be the father of the Constitution, "The people are the only legitimate fountain of power, and it is from them that the constitutional charter, under which the several branches of government hold their power, is derived."
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.